Welcome to the Caribbean Foreign Affairs Podcast, Diplomatically Speaking. I'm Dr. Janet Brown-Metzger, former Jamaican Consul General and your host. Join me for candid conversations with leaders on the front line of U.S. and Caribbean affairs about bilateral relations, U.S.-Asia geopolitical tensions over the region, foreign trade, and why the U.S. should deepen its relationship with the Caribbean in the post-pandemic era. We will also discuss fresh ideas coming from the region for new and diverse economic opportunities and innovative ventures, and what could be a paradigm shift in Caribbean economic strategy. The shock of the pandemic to Caribbean economies across the board has been seismic and is occurring during a worldwide health crisis and global geopolitical shifts between East and West, which has huge implications for the Caribbean. With the disruption of tourism, which accounts for up to 90% of many Caribbean economies, and challenges to meet international debt obligations, Caribbean states are struggling to keep their economies afloat. Here to help us understand what is next for the region is Scott MacDonald, Chief Economist at Smith's Research and Gradings, a financial credit research and analytics grading firm. Dr. MacDonald has decades of experience understanding sovereign debt, international finance, and geopolitical risk, having held senior positions on Wall Street and at such firms as MC Asset Management, Mitsubishi Corporation, Credit Suisse, and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency in Washington, D.C. His doctorate is in political science from the University of Connecticut, where he did his dissertation on Trinidad and Tobago. He has written 18 books and numerous articles, and he has a long-standing interest in the Caribbean. I cannot think of a more thoughtful and studied guest to hold forth on the issue of what's next for the Caribbean than Scott. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. I've been looking forward to this interview for a number of reasons, other than obviously the urgency of the matter. As a Caribbean American, and full disclosure here, an investor in Jamaica, I have concerns about what my investment, and certainly I'm longing to get back there and sit on the beach and enjoy the culture with my family. So I am sure you are feeling somewhat the same.
Definitely. I have to admit, the COVID-19 world is not a lot of fun. I've also got friends in the Caribbean, and one of which is in Trinidad and has been regaling me with 80-degree weather, a nice breeze coming through, sipping wonderful Trinidadian rum. And I'm sitting up here in Westchester County, New York, with 90-degree heat and humidity and no breeze. So definitely the opportunity to go back to the Caribbean and spend time there is something I'd love to get back to.
Well, with any luck, we will be getting back there very soon indeed.
Definitely.
I read your July 2nd article in Global Americans with tremendous interest. It is unreserved in its summation of the situation in the Caribbean, and I want to walk through it with you. By the way, I recommend the piece highly to my listeners, and I will post it on the show's website. You note, starting off, that the Caribbean holds one of the most open set of economies in the world that is dependent on foreign demand and heavily reliant on tourism. We know that. Government leaders have been quick and deliberate in their dealings with the health crisis, in part because there was not enough help coming from key allies who themselves were, quite frankly, overwhelmed. How would you describe the Caribbean's response to the pandemic?
I think, in general, the Caribbean's done a very good job. I mean, there are always going to be exceptions where governments struggle to deal with it, but I think the response in general in the Caribbean was pretty rapid. Governments took control, and I think Caribbean leaders did a good job of responding. They locked down, they cut off links, international travel, and they streamlined the process. I can't fault many of the governments in the region. I know Jamaica's done a pretty good job, Trinidad and Tobago, certainly. You've had, you know, bigger economies like the Dominican Republic have had a little more of a struggle with it. But
right.
As you said, when you have a very open economy and you have dependency on tourism for anywhere between 50 to 90% of your gross domestic product, your employment, it definitely has had a bad impact on all the economies.
Well, yeah, we'll get into that in more detail. And it's interesting that you mention this because we'll talk about what happened recently with Bahamas a little later. But let's just stick with the response by the CARICOM governments. It was really a surprise to me and it left me very crestfallen when we realized that the U.S. was not able to distribute or supply PPE to the region. And what really, to me, as a former diplomat, I found devastating and really concerned about how the region was going to deal with that issue.
Like you said, there was definitely shock value here. But I think to the credit, especially for CARICOM countries, the realization that we're not going to get what we need and the ability to move quickly on it. And, you know, we do sit in a, you mentioned, an east-west geopolitical issue where China and the U.S. have squared off, but the Caribbean leaders in CARICOM were able to eventually access equipment they needed. China did send equipment, and so did Taiwan, for that matter.
Right.
You know, the world is changing. The United States is undergoing a lot of change itself, but I think the message to CARICOM countries is, changes in the air. You guys did respond pretty quickly to it, but going forward, that thought process is going to have to be taken more into consideration.
Oh, we see that last month the IMF prognosticated, and you pointed out a particularly gloomy outlook for the Caribbean. It breaks my heart to be doing this show in a way. And the only reason I must tell you that I feel okay going forward is because you have some really remarkable thoughts around how the region can pull itself out of this crisis. But before we get to the good news, let's just look at what is happening in a little bit more granular fashion. So the IMF comes out with this thing, with this really gloomy, outlook.
To put it mildly.
Yeah, to put it mildly, yeah. We already talked about the devastation to the tourism market. Many of our economies up to 90% reliant on tourism. Just in general terms, where do the rating agencies stand on all of this?
Well, the rating agencies try to look out where they expect things to be anywhere from 10 to 12 months to maybe 2 years out. They've not undergone a big series of downgrades. They have acted in some cases. Jamaica's ratings have held up, but I think they're going to be under pressure, obviously, because everybody's are. Bahamas has been hit. Suriname has had problems, and that's related.
I was very surprised that Bahamas was hit, downgraded significantly. Bahamas has always enjoyed a pretty solid economy, with their currency doing the best, really, in my mind, in the region. What was the cause for this downgrade?
I would say there's a couple things at play with the Bahamas. One is the overwhelming dependence on tourism. The second thing is on a fiscal and debt to GDP ratio. Those numbers have undergone some deterioration through the years. I actually had the pleasure of doing one of the first dollar-denominated bond issues for the Bahamas when I worked for Donaldson, Lufkin, Jenrette back in the 90s. And at that point, the Bahamas was a single-A-rated credit. Now they are not a single-A-rated credit, and those ratings have tumbled. The issue that I think for the Bahamas is we have this overdependence on tourism. Most of our tourists, and this comes up in the write-up, especially with Moody's, most of the tourists come from the United States or Canada. So the outlook for the Bahamas definitely took it on the chin in that regard. You did have ongoing damages from Dorian. I think it was $3.2 or $3.5 billion of damages.
$3.5 billion in damages,
yeah.
Which we're still trying to grapple with. Yeah.
Right. You've had a number of knocks to the economy, and the COVID situation really did trigger it. The Bahamas really probably got hit earlier than some of the other economies. I mean, Jamaica, the story in Jamaica, to me, despite COVID, has been very good. I think the wholeness government has done well in reducing debt. I mean, it was, I think, back in 2012 or later, about 145% of GDP. The push has been to get it under 100%. I think they're in the 90s now. And then down the road to bring it down to 60% of GDP.
To Jamaica's credit, they've also had a good run with a certain amount of diversification in the economy. Yes. They've done pretty well in the business process, what we call the call center business. Although, unfortunately, that has been the cause for a number of the COVID cases coming in. But that's really helped the economy.
You've had diversification. You've had foreign direct investment. You've had improvements in infrastructure. The governments have worked hard to have greater fiscal responsibility. I think if you hadn't had the COVID-19 pandemic, I think Jamaica's trajectory and ratings would have probably been an upward slope.
That's right.
But it's, you know, it is what it is. We've had COVID, we're all adjusting, but Jamaica's also had the ability to tap IMF assistance. I think they took out about $500 million recently from the IMF and emergency program. So I'm more positive and constructive about Jamaica than I am some of the other countries in the region. Mm-hmm. In that regard.
Now, the downturn of advanced economies, certainly the U.S. and the U.K., has made it difficult to access international capital, pretty much gone, evaporated. When is that coming back?
I don't think it comes back until some point 2021, 2022. There's been a sharp bifurcation in a lot of emerging markets. Countries which have been regarded as more frontier economies have had less access to credit. But I think that those markets will probably open up sometime next year, depending on the ability to get past COVID-19. That said, you are seeing restructuring of debt in a number of countries. I guess Grenada is in the process of that. That was leaked out in Latin Finance a couple months ago. Suriname is in the process of restructuring their debt. You've kind of got a number of hurdles. And I think for the Caribbean, it means commercial access or international capital markets are, it's going to be a tough slog to get back in there. It doesn't mean it's impossible, but it's more difficult considering the very uncertain nature of where the economic fundamentals are going.
You mentioned Suriname, and if I may say, typically, it's not a country that comes up necessarily in discussions about the economies of the region, but Suriname is doing particularly well, or had been doing particularly well before this COVID-19 hit. Particularly in its shipping sector. I know that Dubai Port World just made a huge investment in the region in the last couple of years. But talk to me about what you know about Suriname.
Well, Suriname is, I think Suriname's fortunes are definitely looking better over the medium term.
Right.
The issues in Suriname were that you had the Bouterse government, which was democratically elected. He was elected president twice, Desi Bouterse. He had a checkered past, we might say, in terms of he was put on trial and charged with drug trafficking by the Dutch government. He has been pointed to as having illicit relations in terms of gold shipping through Suriname from Venezuela. So you've had a mixed bag. The economy got hit very hard in 2014 and 2015. It rebounded. You had strong growth. The gold industry did well. You had some foreign investment going in. And then over the last year, 2019, there was an effort by the government to pump prime the economy with the elections being held recently in May. And then the issue was, where do we go from there? And government finances got badly squeezed, and then COVID hit, and then you had the election. The good news for Suriname is that you have found commercial qualities of offshore oil, potentially in the same ballpark as in Guyana.
As in Guyana, yeah.
Yes, and that's a big deal for a country like Suriname, which has less than a million people living there. You've had this change in government. There's the new president, Santuque, who I think is a man of integrity, and they basically are going through economic policy. They are trying to do the right things to get their house in terms of debt dealt with because they couldn't make some payments recently, some of the interest payments. But I think the trend line for Suriname could actually be pretty positive here.
That's what I think. And I attribute that potential to the oil.
Yeah, I mean, I think Suriname has some degree of diversification in terms of oil, gold, agriculture. The oil issue has got to be handled, but there's interest in having pretty good programs for just transparency and disclosure. Statoil, which is the nationally owned oil company, has a track record of being in business. And sadly for Guyana, the political issues in Guyana may hurt Guyana in terms of foreign investment going forward.
Well, I think it will definitely hurt Guyana. And it's sad because in the last two or three years, literally right before Tillerson took up his position with the Trump administration, there were these amazing reserves, you know, that were discovered, and it fell right back into this whole trap of the some level of corruption, some concern among its citizens as to how the wealth was going to be shared and distributed. And I see some slight amount of those notions creeping into the narrative with respect to Suriname.
Well, that's always a concern. I think the big difference between Guyana and Suriname is Guyana society is divided, if you want, or society is made up of two large groups of people, people of East Indian descent and people of African descent.
Right.
In Suriname, you have, you know, what has been in the past called Hindustanis, but people of Indian descent, you have people, though, of Javanese descent, you have people of African descent, European descent, and I think you also went through a traumatic period of social conflict with the Maroons who lived in the hinterland of the country, where they were probably on the bottom economically, and that was during the 80s, where you actually had a conflict in terms of issues. The current vice president, Ronnie Brunswick, comes from a Maroon background. So Suriname, in some ways, has gone through a traumatic experience of actual armed conflict that took place, and it was never a full-scale society, but it definitely sent the message that if we don't manage all of this correctly, we will have problems.
Right.
And I think looking forward, there is a desire to avoid some of the pitfalls.
One of the things I also wanted to talk with you about is this, concern about the downturn of remittances from people like myself, Caribbean people who are in the diaspora, whether it's the U.S. or the U.K., those numbers, those, you know, revenue flows have fallen, I think, what, somewhere around 10%, maybe even more?
Probably more, probably closer to 12%.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a big issue. I mean, the problem with COVID was that, you know, it's twofold. One, it hit supply and it hit demand. You shut both down together. The difficulty is restarting it. That relates back to the issue of remittances in that all of a sudden you've kind of shocked the system and you've raised up unemployment levels. And now the scramble is to put the pieces back together.
Right.
But that disruption means that the flow of remittances to the Caribbean from North America and from Europe has been under pressure. It has declined. And that also hurts the region in terms of having an extra source of capital to help keep things going.
Well, the truth of the matter is it's more than an extra source of revenue. It is a significant source of revenue. I know where Jamaica's concerned, it is up there bigger, I think, than the revenue generated by tourism.
Well, it's the same thing in Cuba. I think remittances count for around $2 billion. I can't remember the exact number, but
somewhere, yeah, exactly.
And the Dominican Republic as well.
I want to talk about, spend, you know, the rest of the time we have together talking about how the region gets out of this hole. Obviously, our biggest partners, the U.S. and the U.K., are themselves in desperate straits. you know, any help that we can expect to get from them, we need to kind of manage our expectations. You say that multilateral institutions need to be more flexible. The IMF, the World Bank, in terms of how they, you know, providing assistance to the region. What do you mean by that?
Part of the Caribbean's success is that the Caribbean in general has been considered middle income. Most countries in the Caribbean are not considered as lower income. If you're lower income, then your ability to tap IMF, World Bank facilities and multilateral organizations is easier. If you're middle income, it's more difficult. So the realization has to be that there's a bit of a sliding scale here in terms of needs. And even if a country has a middle income per capita, it doesn't mean that they're going to be quicker to rebound from the problems that are facing them. So in that regard, and I think there has been a pushback with the Inter-American Development Bank, the IMF, and the World Bank to be more flexible in that regard. The other aspect of this is going to be, how do we sort out the debt issue? It doesn't do anybody any good to totally turn a credit spigot off of countries during this particular time.
Well, in that whole scheme of things, several countries within the region and some of the bigger countries, namely Jamaica and Barbados, and I think Trinidad is part of this discourse as well, they're asking for debt forgiveness. How likely is that?
I think, you know, there may be some debt forgiveness, but I think in general, most multilateral institutions do not want to do debt forgiveness. But if it gets to the point where the debt has not been repaid for a long period of time, I don't see it immediately on the horizon. They may be asked for, but I don't see it in the short term.
Part of there are some who believe that part of this recovery or digging the region out of the hole will mean deepening its relationship with China. I kind of, you know, refer to this in my opening remarks about the geopolitical push and pull between the East and the West. This has been a struggle which has kind of mounted or heightened in the last, I would say, certainly 10 years, but certainly in the last 3 to 5 years, even more so. And I think COVID has really put like a dot on that, given the fact that China was where the region had to turn to get help with COVID, not only in terms of its PPE, but actual funding in terms of its mitigation plan in handling the pandemic. I would love to hear your thoughts on that whole geopolitical push-pull tension and how you think it's going to shake out with respect to the Caribbean-U.S. relationship.
In many ways, we are in a new Cold War between China and the U.S. China came into the Caribbean in a more pronounced fashion, I would say, starting off in about 2010. And it accelerated, and it found the Caribbean useful for a number of reasons. One, natural resources play a role, certainly. Secondly, Chinese companies had the mandate starting in the 1990s to go global. So that means if you're a Chinese construction company and you need to employ Chinese workers, you end up in the Bahamas, you end up in Antigua and Barbuda, you end up in Trinidad. And China came in at a time when U.S. interest in the region declined. The U.S. was more busy. You know, the Cold War came to an end. The U.S. became busy with Iraq, Afghanistan, the war on terror. So the U.S. more or less pulled out, you know, kept some residual interest, Haiti and Cuba, and some degree of relationships, and certainly trade was very important, and the other issues being migration and drugs.
Which, if I could just cut you off there, apologize. It's not so much that the interest declined, in my humble opinion. The interests that you just identified have always been there and continue to be a priority, certainly for the region. Security, we are the third border to the United States. We have a huge immigration interest. The U.S. is our biggest trading partner. So I contend that the interest hasn't declined. I contend that the U.S. chose to kind of ignore it or take the region for granted.
Yeah. My point is, the interest from the Caribbean side did not decline. The interest and the ability of the U.S. to focus on the Caribbean, as it had done during the Cold War, did decline in that regard. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mean. it's a very important point. Yes, like the expression that Porfirio Diaz said in Mexico about the United States, which was, if I can remember correctly, so far from God and so close to the United States. That's a paraphrasing. I'm sure I didn't get it just right, but the view is, you know, geography plays a role here. If you are in the Caribbean, you cannot ignore the United States. If you're in the United States, ultimately you cannot ignore the Caribbean, but it sometimes gets put down as a lower priority. And I think you had this at the end of the Cold War, the 2000s, and beginning of the second decade of the 21st century. China enters the scene. It does economic statecraft. It has nice checkbook. The Caribbean has lots of needs for infrastructure. 2009 hits with the financial crisis. Any type of lending in general from the United States, Canada, and Europe as well declines as those governments deal with fiscal and debt matters at home. There's less money to go in for infrastructure. China comes along and says, well, I'm going to join the Caribbean Development Bank, I'm going to join the Inter-American Development Bank. Antigua, you need a cricket stadium. Let us build that for you.
Jamaica needs roads. You put in the big highway.
I rode on the highway.
But the challenge always is that the Chinese bring in their own, you know, workers. And so they're operating in an environment where, you know, unemployment is in many cases in the double digits. It's difficult for me to square a deal where they would bring in thousands of workers.
The upside of China is that they're there. They have a checkbook. They've been willing to help finesse things in the region, infrastructure. The downside is, just as you said, in the Bahamas, resentment over Chinese workers. We're not going to employ local Bahamians. Instead, we're going to employ Chinese. Pollution's an issue. Chinese companies do not adhere or their track record is not as good in terms of pollution. That's the issue in Jamaica with the aluminum plant. There's upside and downside. But I would say the big thing that's happened is the U.S. has gradually reawoken to the issue of the Caribbean. There has been a more sustained push to be engaged. The real shock value of China being in the Caribbean probably came when the Dominican Republic dropped its relationship with Taiwan and opted for that relationship with China.
Well, Scott, drill down a little bit into your point about this uptick in terms of the U.S. interests in the Caribbean in more recent years.
Well, first, you had a Caribbean 2020 plan, State Department put together. It's the first thing that was done in a long time. It was a feel-good document, but it didn't offer the financial largesse that came from China, but it was an effort to do something in the realization that, hey, we got to pay attention to the Caribbean. It's important.
And what is the status of that program right now?
Basically, it was to offer more things through OPIC, which has got a different name now, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, but there were a number of things that they would facilitate. But in general, it was a continuation of programs already in place.
The only reason I ask you to do that, because it is exactly that. It's a continuation of programs already in place. The Obama administration, through, I think it was a congressman from in New York, had advanced the Caribbean U.S. Engagement Act. I'm not sure the exact terminology, which sadly for me sat on, you know, the table for years. Yeah. I think the expectation was that this, if a Democratic government had gone in place, it would have been operationalized. But that basically is a non-entity right now. So it's a white paper. What we're talking about here is a white paper because it doesn't have the gravitas of funding behind it to really push it. And what little funding there is, it's so meager.
Yeah, I mean, that is my essential concern about that was, it goes back to, where's the beef? This is a package of nice things kind of put together, but the reality was it continued a lot of things. And if you're dealing with economic statecraft and you put it up against China, it really didn't offer a lot. But what I mean by the U.S. upping the presence, suddenly you end up with secretaries of state visiting the Caribbean. Tillerson, Pompeo, also paying closer attention to Venezuela, to Cuba.
Right. And all around the concept of the oil, which is important.
Well, it's oil, but I also think, let's put it this way, U.S. politics being what they are, there are interest groups in the United States that come out of the diaspora of people. And this is another issue which we go back to the linkages between the United States and the Caribbean. There's a large Dominican community. There's a large Venezuelan community, Cuban community.
Right.
So what you've seen through this period of time is where Bush through Obama, and Obama's big exception being opening up Cuba, it was feel good things. We don't spend much money. We watch foreign aid go down to trickles in many cases. And you've seen with the Trump administration, there's a bigger push. We're paying attention. We're upping our naval presence to deal with narco trafficking. The big issue to me at the end of the day is if you want to play economic statecraft, you eventually have to put your money where your mouth is. And this, it's slowly coming from the U.S., and there are good people in the State Department, and there are good people that want good policies for the Caribbean, but it has to be knocked up to higher levels to make some hay. And we're inching in that direction. We have a big election here in November. We'll see where the Caribbean plays out in the election and who wins in terms of the presidency.
I'm happy that is happening, because my own personal viewpoint is that I think the future of the region heavily depends on strengthening its relationship with the United States. That's my point of view. And that doesn't mean that we can't have relationships with other parts of the world. And I'm not so naive that I don't appreciate that all relationships come with a certain amount of strings attached. But I am concerned that America needs to step up, which I think is your point as well in your article. You use that language, that America and the UK need to step up if they are going to do it, and if there is a hope that the relationship between the Caribbean and Europe and the U.S. will stabilize and get to a place where we can begin to see the kind of simpatico and connection culturally and otherwise, I think now is the time to do it. Unfortunately, the cost is going to be huge because of the pandemic. And just kind of, figuring out, how to deal with that. It's going to cost a lot of money. So I realize that. Meanwhile, China, as you say, has these deep pockets, lots of cash, looking for places to place the cash. The Caribbean is welcoming them with open arms. So I think part of my initial question is, where do you think this is going to end up? I think you began to answer it by saying that you think that the U.S. will do more. Do you see them even doing more than you have described?
Yes, I think at the end of the day, the politics or the geopolitics you're describing, it's a competitive world. It's competitive for Caribbean countries. It's competitive for the United States. It's competitive for China. The Caribbean has seen, in general, China act as a partner. However, China does have a very sharp edge to it. And recently you've seen that China using the COVID crisis as an opportunity to advance its agenda. And what I mean by this is you've watched them crack down on Hong Kong. You've watched them pick a border fight with India. You've watched them pump in a lot of extra money recently into Iran. And the recently there was Chinese ambassador to Sweden. They picked a fight with the Swedes because the Swedes stand up for human rights and so on. And the Swedish ambassador made a comment which was quite telling in many ways, is that, for our friends, we have fine wine, and for our enemies, we have shotguns.
Shotguns, yeah.
And what a statement. The Caribbean has not felt the shotguns. They've had the fine wine so far. However, if you cross China, then you'll see the shotgun side of the equation. My concerns, one, Chinese companies tend to pollute. Two, as China presses more and wants its way, it's going to put more pressure on governments in the Caribbean to do what it wants them to do in international forums. You said it, the issue of strings attached. The Chinese want to be in the Caribbean, but they want something back out of it.
To your point, and I think I mentioned to you that I had a guest on, the president of the Caribbean Shipping Association, who's also a member of a tech committee of the IMO. And this is an issue. Only 30% of the region is in compliance with respect to the IMO, where you have a heavy-handed investor like China and the certain amount of reticence on the part of the U.S., then to me that is a formula for a real worry. Because just in general, looking at our region, our biggest asset is our environment. With the exception of Trinidad and Ghana, who have gold and oil, and we talked about Suriname, for most of the region, it is our environment. And I would be unreasonable to say that I'm not concerned that we could be developing this relationship, to the peril of our environment.
I mean, I think part of the future post-COVID for the Caribbean is what's been called the blue economy, where you take the sort of package of issues, everything from tourism, waste management, ecosystem, shipping, how much you pull from the ocean and the environment is really critical as to where the Caribbean goes ahead. Part of this, equation is who do you invite into your country as a partner? Are you willing to cut corners? The environmental issue raises cost. And one of the issues I think that faces Chinese companies working in the Caribbean going forward is if Caribbean countries are more stringent about concerns over social governance, over the environment, there may be some pushback on the Chinese part that, look, we don't want it that way. We don't want to pay these things. We want this. And then you're going to find where there's a disparity or a divergence of views and national interests.
Let us end on a positive note. What is your thinking about where things will be in another 12 to 36 months?
Obviously, the two big factors are, one, do we have some sort of medical breakthrough in terms of COVID? I think if you get a vaccine, that would be a big help, because then that reopens the ideas of having populations which can then travel again.
And we're setting aside for the moment, Scott, the whole issue of access by emerging markets and developing countries, because that's not only a logistics issue. To me, it may even have some tinge of geopolitics in it. Who will have access to the vaccine? But that's for another show, but continue.
You're opening up another whole dimension that can be
right
for a long time. I'm watching Suriname closely because the change of government's important there.
I am too, yes.
Because Bouterse was in China when the court in Suriname passed the verdict that he would have 20 years in jail for the December 1982 massacre, if you want, of 15 dissidents to the government at the time. He then also had been visiting Cuba. He's been good friends with the Maduro government in Venezuela. The new government's come in, and I think what you're going to see is they're going to step back in part from that. They're not going to lose their independence, but they may step back from that, and they may work more with the U.S. and the Netherlands, and with the view that we need help with the debt restructuring. That is something very important to watch. I would also say, looking out on the horizon, the big issues that sit here, one is, I think the Caribbean in general needs to rethink how heavily dependent you want to be on tourism. There has to be a rethink as to food security issues, and there has to be greater thought to digitalization of Caribbean economies. And I think because of COVID, certainly here, we've seen a big push in that direction, but it's going to occur within the Caribbean. And the last thing, which I think is very important for the Caribbean, is the development of a new Cold War between the U.S. and China means a disentanglement of the U.S. and Chinese economies. And it means a reconstruction of global supply chains. You mentioned call centers, but the Caribbean has a well-educated workforce on a comparative basis to a lot of places on the planet.
Not to mention the cultural connections and similarities.
I mean, most people in the Caribbean either know somebody in North America or Europe, or, you know, they've traveled there.
Right.
You know, there's a much greater awareness. So I think the issue of global supply chains and reorganization could also benefit the Caribbean. And you are watching fintech. COVID thing kind of knocked everything sideways, but I've watched Barbados. So I think there's a lot of things which are going on. There are very tough issues that need to be resolved. But in general, I think if we're looking at the Caribbean, you know, a year down the road, I think you're going to find the mood is more positive, and you may see some things occurring which we wouldn't have expected, you know, 12 months ago.
And also, if I could say, things that have been on the table that governments have been dallying with but just have not really moved up as a priority, one of them is the whole agricultural sector. Food security is, or insecurity, is almost an oxymoron when you talk about the Caribbean, where you can grow anything that you want. The fact that a country like Bahamas spends almost $2 billion a year bringing you food for tourists is a little strange to me. We've always talked about the need to kind of get our agriculture sector up and going. So maybe now is the time to do it.
You look at Cuba. Cuba imports most of its, a good chunk of its food. Cuba has used to be a world powerhouse in terms of production of sugar
in America. Sugar and bananas.
You've had innovations in agriculture in Cuba, but Dominican Republic's another place that can produce more food. Jamaica, Trinidad. But food security is something, I think, which is going to require more attention going forward.
Yes, absolutely. Well, my good heavens, you know, you have a very facile brain. Obviously, you are extremely studied and knowledgeable about this, and I could talk with you forever. We'll just have to have you back. But for now, I thank you so very much, Scott, for sharing your expertise and your knowledge and your time. So for you all, check out my website, please, diplomaticallyspeaking.com, and I'll see you around next time. God bless. All good. Thank you for listening to Diplomatically Speaking, the Caribbean Foreign Affairs podcast that keeps you up to speed on the issues about the most pressing matters of our time concerning the region and how they connect to you. We hope you'll join us again for another exciting conversation. Please visit us online at www.diplomaticallyspeaking.com and share this podcast with others. Until next time, walk good.